Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to Top of the Morning on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. As we approach the middle of the summer, investors continue to deal with a number of pesky market risks, including the prospect of the Fed hiking rates, a resumption of hostilities between the U.S. and Iran, a new wave of tariffs, and ongoing concerns about AI capex spending. Yet through all that, the S&P 500 has been relatively steady. So joining us here on this Monday morning to talk about those market risks and the market outlook from here, glad to welcome back Jason Dreho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office. Jason, great to be back at the table with you. Thank you for dropping by.
It's good to be here. Happy Monday.
And let's begin with the Fed, because the FOMC meets this week. Timely that we're covering this topic, and the Fed will be deciding whether to hike interest rates. What are CIO's expectations?
Well, you know, going into this meeting, I'd say there's an unusual amount of uncertainty. You know, normally the Fed provides enough guidance that there's expectations either they will hike or they don't hike. This time, I think it's relatively uncertain. The FOMC committee members have been split recently. If we go back to the June FOMC meeting, it was almost 50-50 in terms of those who thought we should that they should hike at least once this year, and the other half basically saying like we should stay on hold. In addition to that, we have Fed Chair Kevin Warsh. His views are a bit of a mystery still. He's kind of refusing to provide kind of forward guidance. And also, we've had this re-escalation of the U.S.-Iran conflict really during this blackout period. Oil prices have gone higher. We have not had any real comments from officials, you know, since it's really kind of escalated, to get a sense of how they interpret this overall development. So a lot of uncertainty. It's reflected in market pricing. As of, you know, Monday morning, it's roughly about a 33% chance of a hike in this month, and also one full hike priced by September. Normally, either you're going to be high, like 80-90%, or you're going to be low, like 10-20%. So it's not quite at 50-50, but pretty close to that. In terms of what we expect, ultimately, we think the Fed is going to be on hold this meeting. The inflation data we got for June, you know, showed a step down. So an improvement in inflation data. So if you're willing to hike when inflation was higher in June, then the inflation data has not sort of gone in the direction that would sort of, you know, make it even more adamant you need to hike, you know, right now. There also is the case that, you know, the Fed generally doesn't like to surprise the markets, you know, and again, this is a different Fed under Kevin Warsh, less focused on forward guidance. It doesn't really want to provide it. So perhaps that's not the past is not a kind of prologue in this case, but typically the Fed does not like to surprise the markets. And there's not going to be any updated economic projections, dot plots. There will be a press conference that's been kind of confirmed, you know, but we don't know, or if the Fed does change rates, we won't know, like, what is the policy framework? What's the details that would sort of justify the hike at this point in time? Now, assuming they don't hike, then we'll probably see an FOMC statement that acknowledges that the risks to inflation posed by these renewed geopolitical, events are there, and that there are also likely to be at least one, if not more, dissents, which would be, you know, not surprising, but also kind of speak to the fact that the committee is still somewhat divided on this. In some way, it really does kind of depend on Warsh. There are people who probably do want to hike who are more adamant about hiking versus those who want to stay and hold. If Warsh is in the camp of wanting to hike, he could probably convince those who'd be on hold to go in that direction versus those who want to hike, it'd be harder to kind of get them to say, no, we need to hold. But we just don't know exactly where, his kind of thinking is.
Right.
Now, some of his rhetoric has been relatively hawkish. He's made, in the past couple of weeks, comments that, you know, inflation is a choice, you know, that they could choose to accept inflation above 2% or they could take action. I think there's a risk that if they keep talking really tough and they don't take action, then they lose some credibility. Right. So these things would suggest that perhaps that Warsh would lean in that direction, but he's given no indication. And sort of if he wasn't willing to do it in June, given the inflation data, one would think that perhaps they don't want to do it in July. So that's where we would come out. They won't hike this time. The market is leaning in that direction, but it is not a toss-up close to it.
A bit of a commercial. Your colleague Andrew Dubinsky will be joining me on Thursday morning for a post-FOMC takeaway top of the morning. So coverage on both sides. One factor, Jason, that could influence the Fed's decision is the rise in oil prices because of the resumption of fighting between the U.S. and Iran, which you mentioned a few moments ago. Do you see this as a factor that could impact the Fed's decision?
It's possible. I think not necessarily this time. And again, we don't know, given the blackout period, you know, how they're sort of interpreting this. Typically, the Fed will look through these kind of oil price shocks. And if you want to assume, I think it's a fair assumption that you know, the situation is sort of an unsteady equilibrium between the U.S. and Iran. You know, they'll get some escalation, then some de-escalation, not necessarily a clear, sustained truce. But because of that, and we've seen over the weekend a couple of days of somewhat more muted military action on both sides, you've seen oil prices come down as a result, kind of validating that conjecture for the markets and perhaps, you know, for the Fed as well. Now, that's, you know, that would be the normal sort of circumstances. You know, but I think there's enough commentary from FOMC officials that, you know, they would support hiking if the inflation news doesn't improve and higher oil prices for longer kind of could tip them in the balance in that direction. Obviously, there's relatively little margin for error on inflation, given how high it's been above 2% for now for 5 years. And any persistence in the conflict, you know, that keeps oil prices higher, you know, will matter for rates because it just increases concerns about are these supply shocks just going to be kind of perpetual. Now, even if the Fed has somewhat a limited ability to address supply side shocks, I mean, really raising rates is more about curtailing demand. They can't really address supply problems. You know, the committee members, the FOMC, the Fed overall, they feel that they have to respond in order to avoid kind of the perception among the public, the investors, that they're not really credible, that they're willing to tolerate high inflation, even if they're limited to what something they can do. And the impact is somewhat ineffective. Again, just for credibility, like, you know, they will do what they can. So there's that possibility. They may also be just thinking that the longer inflation stays higher for longer, it is going to anchor inflation expectations. But it's also sort of difficult to know in real time if that's happening. So far, that hasn't been the case. But if you want to err on the side of caution, you'd rather say, well, let's avoid that possibility. And, you know, again, this could sort of cause them to hike. So under normal circumstances, you'd say the Fed would look through these, you know, oil price rises that are inflationary. Given where the inflation dynamics have been for the past 5 years, there's probably less, you know, your tolerance for that. They're more willing to take action, even though the policy response may have limited impact to deal, obviously, with what's going on in the Middle East.
Something else to account for, another inflation risk and challenge for the Fed, is the announcement of new tariffs. We've heard that recently from the Trump administration. How relevant of a factor is that, Jason, for inflation and the Fed outlook?
I'd say the short answer is not very relevant, for at least for inflation and therefore probably for the Fed. What was announced last week was these new Section 301 tariffs that were sort of calibrated ultimately to be very similar rates for the expired 122 tariffs and before that the kind of the emergency IEEPA tariffs. What that means in practice is that the overall effective tariff rates on U.S. imports is essentially unchanged. You know, if you actually do the math, maybe it is a plus or minus 10 or 20 basis points. But all things considered, you know, it's kind of doesn't make a major change. And what we know is that the sort of tariff-related inflation for the tariffs that were imposed last year, that is coming down. And you can look at it by saying, like, which goods are being, you know, tariffed, look at the import prices, see the inflation on those goods. That's been declining, which was expected. You know, tariffs are sort of a one-time price level increase. You know, on a year-over-year basis, once you get past that one-year mark of where the tariffs are imposed, inflation levels should drop. So we're seeing that already. If the effective tariff rate essentially remains the same, then you really shouldn't get sort of any sort of, you know, knock-on effects overall. So ultimately for the Fed, you know, I think this is, of the pecking order of things that matter, this is probably relatively low, you know, given sort of it's essentially maintaining a status quo. Now, the one thing that is a little bit different with these tariffs just overall is that they are the result of months-long investigations, and they're kind of harder to remove compared to, you know, the 122, which had a 150-day expiration, or the IEEPA emergency tariffs, which the Supreme Court sort of struck down. So they will stay in place probably, you know, indefinitely. That doesn't mean, again, they'll be inflationary, but it just also means that there isn't, or it's probably a lower risk that some sort of ruling could be put into place or changes in policy that take them off that would be disinflationary down the line.
Another concern to be mindful of, the concerns seem to be piling up this morning, Jason. AI CapEx spending and the return on investment, especially with the focus on open source AI models. How much of a risk is this to the markets, Jason?
Well, this concern about AI CapEx spending has been around for probably a couple of years. Like, all this is a massive amount of spending, and you're seeing numbers continue to ramp up as we go through earnings season. We'll get more of the hyperscalers reporting, you know, this week. As those numbers go higher, the question is, like, when will you get a real kind of return on investment. Compounding that is that if there are open source models where, you know, it's as opposed to, you know, closed source where the proprietary frontier labs are sort of introducing these models, charging various users for the services, if essentially you have open source where someone can take it and sort of download it on their own systems, the thought will be, well, then how do you monetize this content if essentially you're giving away the product for free? So this is sort of added to it. And there's a lot of developments, even in the open source kind of world in the past, you know, month or so. In some way, it kind of really boils down to, in my mind, does the release of these open source models, you know, alter the demand for compute? That is, and therefore that would reduce or alter the demand for kind of the investment. Effectively, I think the view that we have in CIO is that it's much more likely that these models will increase the adoption of AI and therefore the demand for compute. And it's going to be some sort of combination of like frontier models where you pay for certain proprietary services and other models that you kind of apply specifically. If there's demand for compute actually goes higher, it's, you know, this is sort of the Jevons paradox that you make something cheaper, you actually increase demand, so overall revenue can increase. Then more demand for compute, therefore the suppliers for the compute technology, what semiconductors or semiconductor equipment, actually kind of goes up. So all that would sort of support that there will be some sort of, you know, kind of return, you know, on investment. Another thing that sort of, you know, from the tech companies, and this just gets into the market implications, is that for a lot of the hyperscalers, you know, they view this as an AI sort of a winner take all and therefore an existential battle. And if they don't invest, you know, overinvest potentially rather than underinvest, the risk is that they will fall behind and never be able to kind of properly catch up. So even if the returns in the near term are low, ultimately they'll keep kind of buying and investing because they think, you know, if they kind of establish a permanent presence and expertise, they won't kind of maintain that advantage. That's a thesis that will be tested over time. But in the near term, I think companies will continue to spend, that will continue to reflect in different parts of the AI kind of, you know, value chain. And the final thing on this whole topic is that, and it goes back to kind of the open source models to some extent, you know, they may allow also for the growth of agentic AI to be even more rapid and greater and more sort of exponential. And it's likely that by 2030, the vast majority of the demand for compute is going to come from agentic AI, like applications that are being done. So again, all these things suggest that the demand is going to grow faster than compute, and therefore that will generate, you know, an adequate return on investment. Enough that these concerns, at least in the near term, you know, we've had them sort of linger, then the markets have rallied. That this will probably be the persistent dynamic kind of going forward.
With this inventory of risk considerations in mind, and mindful as well that we're heading into August, you know, a summer slowdown period of sorts. And I will note that we won't be having an episode next week. We'll be taking a bit of a pause just so our listeners can mark that down.
We need to refresh ourselves from all these risks that we're dealing with, Dan.
So hopefully we end on a bit of a brighter note in terms of the market outlook, Jason, where we go from here, given these market risks. What does CIO recommend at this time?
So on that point, you know, these, you know, various risks we talked about have been present in the past couple of weeks or even the past couple of months. Despite all that, it is, you know, the S&P 500 has basically been in a range of 7350 to 7550, a pretty tight range. And so it's, you could say it's withstood these kind of headwinds, these challenges after obviously a very strong rally in the second quarter, still good performance year to date. We're looking at, you know, 9% total return to the S&P 500. A little bit past the midway point of the year. Good results, you know, overall. Ultimately, you know, these are risks. They're not the base case. Our base case is still that most of these things ultimately, you know, don't sort of materialize in a significant way, that the Fed does not hike rates, that, you know, the situation in the Middle East, you know, stays kind of status quo or improves, and so the oil prices, you know, can go lower, that the flow of oil kind of, you know, normalizes. On the economic fundamentals that support all this, and that's part of why the Fed is, you know, potentially hiking it, is that economic growth remains resilient. We're seeing consumer spending continue to hold up. Manufacturing activity in the U.S. and globally is solid. So solid kind of growth that's contributing to some of these inflationary pressures, which is why the possibility of Fed hikes is even sort of being discussed. But the economic growth that is supportive for, and we think it will be solid going forward, that is supportive for risk assets, you know, overall. You know, part of that's reflected ultimately by, you know, corporate earnings. We are only about a third of the way through the second quarter earnings season for the S&P 500, but the results are coming in very much in line, if not better than expected. You know, our team forecast 28% EPS growth for Q2 year over year, and we're tracking that, if not a little bit, you know, better than those results. So very good kind of numbers, you know, overall. Equity markets to some extent are kind of shrugging it off. It's a little bit of the buy the room or sell the news or arrive and travel and arrive, meaning, you know, once you actually get the news, it's like, okay, we expected it. And you're you're not seeing a big market pop, but it's also good that it means the valuations are actually probably getting cheaper rather than sort of more expensive overall. Add this all up. This is why we look at equities as being kind of attractive globally in the U.S. The latest house view update, about 10 days ago, we upgraded, the Eurozone equities to attractive, a little more cyclically based. And that does feed into one of the key messages of like kind of diversifying across equities, but in particular, kind of leaning into kind of a cyclical rotation to some extent. So sectors in the U.S. that we like, including like financials, industrial, consumer discretionary, that will benefit from this kind of relatively solid economic environment. That's kind of how we would lean into that direction. That also includes emerging markets, which has some of those drivers as well. On the fixed income environment, rates have been obviously kind of jostling around. If the Fed doesn't hike as we kind of expect, and ultimately the path going forward under our inflation assumptions is that they would cut at some point, early middle of next year, you could see interest rates kind of go lower at the front of the curve. The intermediate part, like the 10-year part, could still be very much range bound, which is why we tend to favor more, let's call it the belly of the curve, up to about 5 or 7 years. It's why within corporate credit, we tend to favor more of the high yields, relative to IG, just because it has shorter duration. You're not getting this massive supply of longer duration, from hyperscalers issuing debt to finance the CapEx buildout. But generally a diversified fixed income, kind of higher quality portfolio. So a relatively constructive view overall. And so again, these are risks that we've covered throughout this call, sure, not the base case. And they will persist, but the market so far have been able to kind of swat them away. And I like to think that, mosquito season, it tends to kind of peter out as the summer goes on. So hopefully these risks dissipate, but they're probably going to persist into August, maybe even into, late in the summer as well.
Well, helpful to be knowledgeable about the scope of risks out there and to have a good understanding of how CIO sees the market outlook taking shape in the months ahead. So always a very helpful touch base, Jason. Thank you for dropping by on this Monday morning. Enjoy the time away next week and do look forward to regrouping here with our listeners in a couple of weeks' time.
You're welcome. Have a great week.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.